website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Today is Tuesday, June 6, 2023. What a beautiful day it is here in Minnesota. Hope the same is true for wherever you are around the world. I'm going to start off just by acknowledging that our friends at the Minnesota Department of Health want you to know that COVID-19 vaccines are free, because we want you to stay safe, be aware of COVID-19. I also want to begin the program by inviting those who may be joining us from any of the various platforms that we're on to support this program by becoming subscribers to our YouTube channel. Now, as well as being live here on KFAI and KFAI.org, we're streaming live to YouTube, the Insight News channel. We're streaming live to YouTube, the NNPA, Black Press of America channel. We're also streaming live to Facebook, Insight News, Facebook, Al McFarland, Facebook, Black Press USA. Finally, we're streaming live to Twitter and LinkedIn. So no matter where you connect, say hello to us, shout us out, shout your community out in the comment, and tell some friends that the conversation is going on right now. We promised a robust conversation, and you are part of that. We'd love to have your ideas as well, things you want us to talk about, people you want us to connect with, we want to connect with as well. Well, today is going to be a great program. I'm pleased to have Brother Chad Williams. Chad Williams is a professor and historian, and his work includes his specialty, his examination through the book called The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War. And It focuses on Du Bois' perspectives on race and racism during the First World War, how those views influenced the broader African American intellectual history and the civil rights movement. Well, Brother Williams, good afternoon. Welcome to the conversation. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you, first of all, and where do you teach? Talk about yourself first. Give us a Chad Williams 101.
Well, I'm originally from California, Bay Area. I went to college at UCLA, made my way out to the East Coast for graduate school at Princeton University, where I received my doctorate in history. I'm currently a professor at Brandeis University, just right outside of Boston in Massachusetts.
And so talk about the book, this work, The Wounded World. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, it's really a remarkable story that I tell in The Wounded World about W.E.B. Du Bois and one of his most significant and unfinished projects. He worked on a massive book on the Black experience in World War I, titled The Black Man and the Wounded World, for over two decades, and never finished and never published what would have been one of his most significant works of history. So in my book, The Wounded World, I tell really the epic story of Du Bois trying to finish his history of the war, but also what it tells us about Du Bois himself and the broader history of African-American struggles for freedom and democracy in the 20th century.
So walk us through everything you just talked about. That was a whole lot. Number one, the status of his book. Did the book ever, will it be published? Can it be published? Or is the work remaining, going to remain as it is, unfinished projector?
It's really a remarkable manuscript. It's over 800 pages long. Some parts of it are complete. Other parts are incomplete, just a collection of notes and drafted chapters. Ideally, I would like to try and edit the manuscript in some form or fashion and present it to the public. because I think it's really a remarkable example of Du Bois as a historian, but also just his tremendous intellect and the ways in which he struggled, deeply struggled with the complicated history of World War I, his personal place in it, as well as the larger place of Black people in the history of the war.
So tell us about W.E.B. Du Bois. This, my audience is here, might or might not be familiar with this giant intellect for America, the world, and actually from the Black community. What's the W.E.B. Du Bois story?
W.E.B. Du Bois is one of the most remarkable individuals in American history, certainly one of the most remarkable scholar activists in African-American history. He lived just a truly incredible life, 95 years. He was born in 1868, just a few years after the end of the Civil War. He dies in Ghana in 1963, literally on the eve of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Just a remarkable life. He was the first African-American to receive a doctorate from Harvard University. He published 22 single-authored books in a whole range of different disciplines, history, sociology, literature, philosophy, and he was one of the founders of the modern civil rights movement as we know it today. He co-founded the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He was editor of its news magazine, The Crisis. He was literally at the forefront of every major issue facing Black people and other peoples of African descent throughout the diaspora in the 20th century.
So walk us through that. I mean, what does that mean when you think about the breadth and depth of his engagement, his analyses? Walk us through it. What were the key things that are signature to understanding how he assembled the world and attempted to have an impact that would be lasting? It certainly has lasted.
Absolutely. Du Bois was remarkably clairvoyant. In 1900, he attended a Pan-African Congress in London. And at that conference, he declared that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. He repeats this in his classic book, The Souls of Black Folk, published in 1903. And he was absolutely right. The problem of the 20th century was indeed the problem of the color line. The problem of the 21st century is arguably the problem of the color line. Du Bois understood the significance of race in the lives of Black people, but he most importantly, and this is something that I talk about in my book, understood the importance of struggling with making democracy a reality for Black people, both in the United States and throughout the broader African diaspora.
Describe, if you would, kind of the fault lines of the movement at that time. He emerges at the turn of the century as an intellectual, as a speaker, as a leader, but there are other energies afoot as well in the country, some competing, some complementary. I think we look back in retrospect and maybe we create a bigger division than what actually existed, but it would be useful for you to say, sort of describe the landscape that he emerged through.
Certainly.
Coming out of slavery, right? The world has changed for us and the world because a generation before, some 4 million were able to walk away from permanent bondage.
Absolutely. And Du Bois is part of a generation of African-Americans who are trying to make sense of the meaning of freedom, particularly in the late 19th century, in the aftermath of Reconstruction, and into the 20th century, the dawn of this new century, whereas Du Bois, as I said, very clairvoyantly wrote, struggling with this problem of the color line, the Negro problem, as it was described at the time. And he was one of several voices who were offering different solutions to trying to think about how to advance and uplift the race. Du Bois's most significant rival at the time, Booker T. Washington, the very powerful principal of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. He was considered to be really the spokesperson for the race, particularly in the eyes of many white Americans. And Du Bois felt that it was necessary for African-Americans, counter to the agenda that Booker T. Washington was pushing, to advocate for their full and unconditional civil rights and state claim to their citizenship as full 100% Americans. This was something that he wrestled with, especially in the context of World War I.
So describe further, if you would, Professor, the distinction in the strategies, the vantage point of viewpoint, the motivation for how Booker T. Washington pursued how we move the race forward versus what W.B. Du Bois was presenting.
Yeah. So quite frankly, I think that Booker T. Washington sometimes gets a bad rap in history. He's oftentimes seen as an accommodationist, a sellout, if you will. But it's important to understand Booker T. Washington in the context of his times and in the context of where he lived in the Deep South, trying to establish a school for Black people in the heart of the Black Belt in Alabama. And he recognized that he had to navigate very treacherous waters in the white supremacist South in order to advance his educational agenda at Tuskegee, but also his economic and social agenda as well. He believed that it was important for African Americans to accumulate wealth, to establish Black businesses, to build a foundation for themselves that was not necessarily reliant on white people. And this was something that he was heavily criticized for making the argument that Black people, as he famously said in his Atlanta Compromise speech, should accept racial segregation, should not fight for their civil rights, should focus on lifting themselves up economically. Du Bois and other African Americans at the time felt very strongly that this was the wrong approach, that African Americans needed to have higher education, not settle for industrial vocational education, as which was being offered at Tuskegee, but to also advocate for their civil rights and not compromise on the fact of their American citizenship in any way, shape, or form.
Both arguments, it seems to me, and please challenge or check me on this, had to do with how we interact and integrate or not. Right. Interact certainly with the power, and that's the colonial or the supremacist power of white mm-hmm. culture, white supremacy. And so on the one hand, as I understand it, and as I read it, Dr. Du Bois talked about developing the intellectual posture and in a sense creating a Black human being that because of his gifts would be appreciated, embraced, and respected by people that despise us and are contemptuous towards us. Mm-hmm. Dr. Washington, on the other hand, said, don't worry about that. Let's plow.
Yeah.
Let's make some crops, let's sew some clothes, let's fix some machines, and let's make some money by doing business, serving each other, and not attempting to disrupt those people who despise us so much. It's simplistic, but is that the direction of the distinction between them?
I think there's definitely some truth to that. And again, it's so important to take Booker T. Washington in the context of his times, the challenges that he faced. I mean, sometimes we don't fully appreciate, and this is something that I try and flesh out in my book, just what it meant to be Black in late 19th century and early 20th century America, particularly in the South, just the depths of American racism, racial violence, this scale of racial oppression that Black people had to contend with. And Booker T. Washington, being from the South himself, being a former slave, was intuitively aware of that in a way that W.B. Du Bois was not. Keep in mind, W.B. Du Bois was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, after the end of slavery. He comes out of a very different environment. He's a very different person temperamentally, intellectually. He understood the race question in a different way, in a more intellectual way than someone like a Booker T. Washington did. So even though they had different approaches, had very different personalities, they were still ultimately trying to solve the same question of how to advance Black people in an American society that did not value their existence, did not value their very humanity.
What were the both opportunities and challenges that Du Bois and others, our community, seized around the war, World War I? I think we looked at it, we debated within the community what our role should be. So talk about that. What was the landscape then?
Absolutely. So this was a very contentious moment for Black people. And as I talk about in my book, for Du Bois himself, should African-Americans support the war? Should African-Americans support their country? And this is, quite frankly, a question, a dilemma that Black people are still wrestling with today. What does it mean to be loyal to a country that is not loyal to you? What does it mean to sacrifice for a country that does not respect your citizenship and your humanity? Du Bois had to make that very difficult choice, which he ultimately did in supporting the war, believing that World War I was going to be an opportunity for Black people to stake claim to their citizenship and expand the boundaries of democracy, both in the United States as well as throughout the broader African diaspora. In The Souls of Black Folk, he writes very poignantly about the double consciousness that Black people face, the sense of two-ness, of being Black on the one hand and being American on the other, and the desire to try and reconcile these two warring ideals, as he describes them. He felt World War I was that opportunity, and he put his credibility on the line in encouraging African-Americans to support the war and ultimately to support their country.
Who were the proponents of competing points of view at that time? Would you say, what, Elijah Muhammad? And others?
Well, this is before Elijah Muhammad's time, but you certainly do have a small number of African-American radical voices who are opposed to the war. Individuals like A. Philip Randolph, Chandler Owen, Hubert Harrison, who were members of the Socialist Party. They believed that it didn't make sense to make America, it didn't make sense to make the world safe for democracy. They needed to make America safe for democracy. Let's make Georgia safe for the Negro before we start thinking about fighting to make the world safe for democracy, as Woodrow Wilson, the president at the time, was promoting. So Du Bois, he certainly faced opposition in his views that African-Americans needed to unconditionally support the war.
And so when you look at that debate, how does it frame the development of the intellectual and cultural history that unfolded from that time, coming out of Reconstruction, coming out of enslavement, to where we are now? What's kind of the steps that we took as a people, and how central is this discussion and his idea to it?
Well, as I talk about in my book, this question about loyalty, of patriotism, is something that has always been incredibly contentious in African-American history, really going back to the American Revolution, where you have African-American soldiers, you know, fighting for the patriot cause, through the Civil War, really through every American war. The question that Black people face of whether or not they should support their country and what should that support actually look like. That's been a central debate, a central question in the long history of African-American intellectualism and African-American political and civil rights history. And that's certainly still something that African-Americans are wrestling with today as we continue to face these larger questions about the meaning of democracy, the failures of democracy as they relate to Black people, and just what place do Black people have in the United States as American citizens.
And how do you think we are assembling or using or coming to reconcile those questions today? What's been the outcome of the examination, the struggle to see which way provides more clarity? I'm sure it's never a question of either or. It's a question of a whole bunch of stuff all the time. But where do we stand right now as you see it?
Well, I think it's an ongoing struggle. I mean, I think we can point to numerous examples around the country today where we still see attacks on Black people, on Black lives, our place in this country. The failures of democracy are really abound. So I think that's an ongoing struggle that African-Americans continue to face. In this country, certainly we have made progress, which is important to recognize, which is something that Du Bois tried to recognize as well, particularly as it related to World War One, but we also have to recognize the ongoing disappointments and disillusionments that Black people continue to wrestle with. And that's something Du Bois certainly had to reckon with, especially as it related, as I talk about in my book, to the history and legacy of World War One.
Does your book, I haven't read it, I apologize, but I will, focus exclusively on the question of Black and white during the war period? Does it examine World War One itself, generally, broadly, and its impact on Black culture, Black people, and our development?
Yeah, so one of the major contributions of my book is to really remind us about the significance of World War One in African-American history, in American history, in world history, more broadly. Black people played an incredibly important role in World War One, a role that, quite frankly, we oftentimes don't acknowledge. That was one of the reasons why Du Bois wanted to write the history of the Black experience in the war, to demonstrate that Black people as soldiers, as well as civilians, but especially as soldiers, made significant contributions to the war. They helped the Allies ultimately emerge victorious, but to also remind us that the war represented this really incredibly divisive and ultimately destructive moment in global history that spoke to the challenges of democracy and just how difficult it was for Black people to stake claim to their full democratic rights and their full humanity during World War One.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. My guest today is Professor Chad Williams. He's written a book on W.E.B. Du Bois, the book The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War. And we're going over this idea of perspectives on race, Du Bois perspectives on race and racism during the First World War, how those perspectives influenced broader African-American intellectual history and civil rights movement. Professor, did you come to this studying Du Bois, or did you come to it studying the military? Is your work in part an examination of the military history of our country or that era?
It's really a combination of both. My book actually comes out of research I conducted for my first book on African-American soldiers in World War One. I was doing research at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where W.E.B. Du Bois's papers are archived, and I came across this remarkable unfinished and unpublished manuscript by Du Bois on the Black experience in the war, and was obsessed with learning more about it, of telling the larger story about what would have been one of Du Bois's most significant works of history that he never finished. So my book is certainly about Du Bois, his political and intellectual evolution, but also the broader history of Black participation in World War One and its significance to African-American history and American history in the 20th century.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm curious as to what you think were the gains, if any, and what were the costs that we paid. I know that we are familiar with the was the Red Summer. It's called after World War One. I think the experience, the thought, the expectation broadly in our community. I remember seeing newsreels of Black soldiers marching through Harlem, for example, getting heroes welcome. Mm-hmm. And I, even as a child watching newsreels like that, I'm not sure where I saw them, gave you a sense of pride, a sense of, wonder and of being. You know, of belonging, because your people like you did the right thing with courage and valor and all the, values. Mm. And so then I also, I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. In a neighborhood where we had a lot of Black people that were in the National Guard that served in the Korean War era. I was maybe a teenager during the Korean War era mm-hmm. or grade schooler maybe. But I was conscious of Black men in uniform, the formations of Black men. And so I'm always curious as to how a person who studies military activity and the role of the military, our role in it, how do you assess what it has meant to us and what we have meant to it, and where in what is the exchange?
Yeah, that's a great question. And shout out to Kansas City. I'm actually going to be giving a talk at the National World War I Museum in Kansas City in a few weeks. Hopefully get some good barbecue while I'm there.
Go to Gates Barbecue.
Okay, I'll remember that. I appreciate that recommendation.
Sure.
So I actually start chapter 5 of my book with the famous Harlem Hellfighters parade in New York City that mm-hmm. you're referring to. They returned back to New York City in February of 1919, triumphantly marching up Fifth Avenue into Harlem. It's this remarkable moment, recognizing their contributions to the war. They're returning heroes. They return to America and New York as heroes. Just a few months later, America is swept into some of the most horrific racial violence in its history. The Red Summer of 1919, as you referred to, where you have race riots taking place throughout the country, race wars in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Black veterans being assaulted, lynched, some still wearing their uniforms. W.B. Du Bois has to make sense of all of this. He's trying to make sense of this both personally, but also intellectually and politically. And he does so the best way that he knows how, is to try and write about it. Du Bois is the consummate intellectual. But Du Bois is ultimately wrestling, again, with that tension of what does it mean to fight for your country, sacrifice for your country, only to return to attacks on your lives, horrific racial violence, attacks on your citizenship and your very humanity. Right? That disillusionment that Du Bois ultimately had to reckon with was reflective of the broader disillusionment that Black people faced in the aftermath of the war, which really spoke to how the war, as Du Bois ultimately came to view it, was a failure for Black people in many ways. Yes, they were able to get significant gains in various areas. We can really point to World War I as laying the foundation for the modern civil rights movement as we know it today.
What would you point to? What in particular would you point to? When you say that, here's what I think when you say that.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody asked me, Al, how was this connected? What was the difference? And I could be wrong, but I would say the difference is that World War I presented a new generation of Black people an opportunity to bear arms. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they weren't particularly defending themselves or their families, but they were defending the nation, and they were defending it against other white people. So what, in my mind, it does is it demystifies this idea of, that white life is sacred and Black life is not.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And the bottom line is it reminds us that if we can die, they can die too.
Absolutely. The very idea of white supremacy is brought into question as a result of World War I. This is why so many white people were terrified of the idea of Black soldiers, especially carrying arms, you know, what that meant for just the complete reversal of the racial hierarchy and the possibility that Black men would be on the front lines, on the Western Front in France, killing other white people, but also experiencing a different world, right? You have over 200,000 Black men who serve in the United States Army overseas in France, right? And this is a remarkable experience for these men, many of whom had never left their homes. They're traveling across the Atlantic, traveling to France, experiencing a different world, a different possibility of race relations, a different possibility of democracy itself. These men are coming back to the United States emboldened, sometimes radicalized, determined that their lives are not going to be the same as they were before. And that's really the founding generation for the modern civil rights movement. Oftentimes we point to World War II as kind of the beginnings of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. But really, the groundwork was laid by that World War I generation.
As a historian, how do you connect in the public mind this idea of military service as something that we have always done, and we've always done well, and whether we've done it under our own direction and leadership as Africans, or under the leadership of colonizers, people who at one level or another appropriated, commanded, control and power of our lives. But we've been in military formations as a culture. And I raised the question because from time to time, it seems that the social structure seeks to have us not be accorded, not be documented, not be acknowledged, and in fact, erase, a wholesale erasure of our presence, our contribution, and our ability to demonstrate the best of what it means to be a human being. And so from a historian's point of view, what's the long lens of our people and military or fighting, I'll put it that way, more broadly, and what do you see as the long lens looking forward? What role will organization, including military organization, play in the liberation, the freedom of Black people, and what role will the freedom of Black people play in the freedom of humanity in this country and around the world?
Yeah, it's an amazing question. And it's a question that W.B. Du Bois, as I talk about in my book, was deeply invested in. Du Bois had great respect for the Black military tradition. Going back to the American Revolution, his great-great-grandfather served in the in the American Army or in the Patriot Army during the war. His father actually fought in the Civil War very briefly. So he had a very personal connection to the history of Black military service, but also as a historian himself, he recognized the significance of Black military service in the long struggle of Black people for freedom and citizenship and democracy in the United States. That's why he wanted so desperately to write about the history of Black people in World War I, a history that he ultimately, very tragically, was not able to finish. But it's a history that I try and tell in my book is very important for us to know, especially in thinking about the history of Black military service beyond World War I, throughout World War II, Vietnam, even up into the present, the ways in which Black military service has been such an important part of the lives of Black people, continues to be such an important part of the lives of so many Black people, embodying the possibilities, the opportunities for Black people to stake claim to their citizenship, but also in many ways representing the hypocrisies, the tensions, the incongruities of what it means to be Black and what it means to be American, especially in the context of the military.
Future-wise, you know, just put your future historian, or I don't know how you call a historian, a futurist, maybe they're one and the same. But so where does it take us as a people? How important, how critically important is it for us to examine the events of the past and through a lens that we own, that we know and feel and attest belongs to us? It's not a reflection of somebody else's definition or projection of someone else's interest, but is genuinely, organically our way of being and seeing the world. Where do we go?
Yeah, well, history has to be our foundation. It has to be the foundation that we use to make sense of, obviously, our past, our place in this country, our place in the world, but how we move forward as well. That was something that W.B. Du Bois, the amazing historian that he was, absolutely understood. But he also appreciated what was adamant that history needed to be obviously accurate, telling the truth in all of its ugliness, in all of its complications. But it was also important to center Black people in the history that we were telling. This was something that he tried to do in the history of World War I that he was writing, something that I do in my book, emphasizing that Black people have always been central actors in American history, and that we have the ability, the necessity, the urgency of telling our own stories.
Maybe you have some favorite stories out of your looking at World War One about our people as soldiers. Anything popped to mind right away? I just was listening to a discussion about, I think it was Charles Young. You familiar with him?
Yes, absolutely.
Talk about him. That's a story that is unknown, that should be known better than it is.
Absolutely. And Charles Young was actually one of W.B. Du Bois's closest friends, mm-hmm. Maybe his closest African-American friend. They met each other when they were both teaching at Wilberforce University and became very close with one another. Charles Young was Black America's military hero, Black America's war hero. He was really Colin Powell before there was Colin Powell. He was that important. And he had the opportunity to become a general, become the first African-American general during World War One. And the army forced him into retirement for quote unquote health reasons. He was someone who Du Bois believed best embodied the possibility of reconciling this tension, this double consciousness between being Black and American. Charles Young had done it. And when he wasn't able to fight for his country during the war, it really broke his heart. And Du Bois writes very poignantly about Charles Young, ultimately his tragic death in Africa in 1923. I talk extensively about
in Nigeria, I believe. In Nigeria, right?
Yeah. In Nigeria, absolutely. So I write extensively about that in my book. And Charles Young is someone who really we should know much more about, but really best kind of encapsulates, you know, the tensions, right? The duality of the Black experience of fighting for your country, of being 100% loyal to your country, but your country ultimately failing you.
I have a friend who lives in Houston, Texas. He lived here in Minnesota for a number of years, retired. I talked to him about 2 weeks ago. He's 103, I think 102. And he was a career Army guy, a sergeant, and fought in World War II. Mm-hmm. But he was trained by the Buffalo Soldiers.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And so, and he was active. I forgot which regiment he was with. With the group that did the campaign in Italy. And I think Luverno is the place that, and that's one from the movie Saint something.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so-
92nd Division, the Buffaloes, yep.
That's so he actually is a highly, highly decorated combat soldier from that assignment and others.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so that's a person that from time to time, I'll try to reach out to him and get him on the program just to remember, you know, and to reflect on what he's done. But, yeah, you know, I still say, I say that to say that I think, well, this is kind of a pivot from what our interview is, but it's a good place to bring it up. I encourage our people to look at military service as one of the ways we develop ourselves. And sometimes you set your politics aside, you do the work, you learn, you know, and you try to gain, or if your politics puts you there, go for it. You know, either way is okay, but get in the middle and and do the work and figure out how to make things work for us right. From our point of view. That's kind of what I think. That's my aside. So I'm glad you're writing about Black soldiers and Black military and how it's within that question, the great questions of our freedom, emancipation, our liberation reside and
absolutely,
can be examined.
Yeah.
What else are you working on? What else are you writing? What else have you written?
Well, as I said, my first book was on African-American soldiers in World War One. I'm currently thinking about the significance of Black studies in African-American history, but also thinking about its significance today, especially as it relates to debates about education, the teaching of history. So that's a project which is still in formation. Right now, I'm just kind of enjoying talking about Du Bois and World War One.
Well, listen, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you've got a hard stop in a couple of seconds here, but I really appreciate you. And I'd love to have you come back to spend more time talking about this book and about history, the role of history in our community. the great historians that we have produced, who I think now are moving the study of history more broadly. There's excitement among ordinary people about knowing and learning and being able to analyze from a lens that reflects who we really are from our point of view. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks so much. I look forward to being back on again.
Chad, thank you so much. Dr. Chad Williams, thank you so much. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. What a great interview. You know, I enjoyed this interview because I mentioned to him before the show started, I've been enthralled with a new learning opportunity called narrative. And narrative is K-N-A-R-R-A-T-I-V-E. It's like knowledge with the K. Well, it's like the word narrative with the K. And I'm encouraging everybody I know, and particularly African-American people, and people that are committed to developing freedom, an Afrocentric view of the world, to look at narrative. One of the things that narrative has created is what they're calling the home for the largest Africana studies classroom in the world. What do they mean? Well, every Saturday morning, I think at around 8:30 or 9:30 our time here, 2,000 to 3,000 to 4,000 people go online to listen to a lecture and a conversation by Dr. Greg Kerr. Quite often, Dr. Kerr is accompanied by or hosted by the creator, co-creator of this project. The co-creator is a sister, Dr. Karen Hunter, who's a world-renowned journalist and reporter and a professor at Hunter College in the New York area. But together, they begun a conversation between the two that sparked a conversation among thousands of Black people. And the guiding principle of the conversation week after week, day after day, is what does it mean to the freedom of Black people? Every conversation, they say, should have at its core, but what does this mean for our freedom? What does it mean for our freedom? And they have engaged in a way that's both enthusiastic, that's loving, that is open-ended, that is respectful, and they've created a process that invites other people in, and the rules of the process are organic, meaning that you kind of know when you show up what the feeling of the room, of the place, of the mission, of the work is. You know that you are among people that have a genuine and deep intellectual and social and cultural and moral interest in what is right and what is true, who have an interest in discussing and determining what the future of our people, Black people, African people, and through that, what the future of our people, human beings, can be. So it's an alignment of our personal lineages and genealogies into our connectedness with every other human being on the planet, but it focuses, it centralizes our thought on our own story, on the truth of our story, the truth of our experience, the history that we bring with us every day, in every breath. So I tell people to check out Narrative, narrative.com. And within Narrative, they've got a special like social community that you have to subscribe to belong to called Nubia. Nubia, you've seen me wear the gear for Narrative in Nubia. Nubia is spelled the same. It's Nubia with a K, so it's spelled K-N-U-B-I-A, Nubia.com. Nifty. I think it's nice. You know, somebody asked me, I was in the grocery store, and they said, Nubia or narrative, what does that mean? And so it's like it's so difficult to imagine the word Nubia with a K or even the word narrative with a K. You answer just like knowledge with a K. And knowledge, you know, is something that you think and know and don't question. It's how the word is constructed in our language. Well, using the same construction rules and opportunity, we present narrative with a K, Nubia with a K, but it suggests the ability to rework what we're working with in ways that suit and feel right for us and for our people. You know, and the key is to discover how to be unapologetic about being Black, how to reflect and walk in a love of yourself and of your family and of your situation that empowers you to be you wherever you are and whoever you are with, in a way that allows you to not have to self-edit and to always second guess. You know, the guest talked about the requirement of Black people. He said, written by W.B. Du Bois, was the importance of understanding double consciousness. What does that mean? Well, you know who you are, who you feel you are inside, but you also know the terror, the oppression of the social structure. And you know that if you, in this society, in our history, coming out of Reconstruction, coming out of slavery, coming out of the pre and now post-civil rights era, but coming out of walking down the street on 30th in Chicago to what's now George Floyd Square, that in any moment, the structural arrangement, the social arrangement, the society that we're in can turn on you and you would be eliminated. And so that awareness is what W.B. Du Bois called double consciousness. So the question is, it's a gift, it's a talent, but is a burden as well. And how do we unify ourselves and unify our minds and our spirits where we obliterate the need, the requirement, the pressure that creates the anomaly of double consciousness, and we emerge whole, we emerge full, we emerge radiant, bright, shining in a way that reflects our commitment to the principle of giving life, of restoring life, of maintaining life. And I'm seeing this in my mind's eye as I'm speaking. And so I have a picture of just radiance and resilience and movement in the world for our people, among each other and among other human beings, all guided by a certain knowledge and a certain respect for who we are and who we are to each other. And that in itself creates a basis for us understanding our relationship to the other elements of existence, the mineral world, the vegetable world, the sentient, the non-sentient. How do we connect? How do we connect? What are we as energy beings? And how do we share existence with everything else that exists in a way that reveals, again, the principle of regeneration in everything we say and in everything we do. I'm going to ask my producer, since we have a few extra minutes, to jump on the conversation and reflect with me on what we've talked about today, this conversation, and on the other conversations we do. And in the process, thank Yasmin Hayes, who is producing this show every day from out in New York. And Yasmin, it's been, and it is great working with you and organizing these shows. Any impressions, any thoughts, any feedback? And thank you for sitting in whenever our technology goes south on me sometimes, and you just pick it up and keep moving. But good afternoon again, Yasmin. And for those on KFAI, if you haven't met her, please meet Yasmin Hayes. She's producer of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. This was a good show.
Yeah, it was. It was. I just, as being a Fisk graduate and just hearing so much about W.E.B. Du Bois, it was just so actually refreshing to kind of hear more about his experience in the connection to world and what his thoughts were regarding about it. I mean, we also always hear about like the economic aspect, the town to tenth, but just to hear about his, you know, I guess the military piece of it and how Black people that transition from enslaved to, I never even thought about that. Like that just, it just gave a really kind of a deeper understanding and appreciation for what W.E.B. Du Bois has brought to us as our community. And I definitely would love to have him on again to kind of share more.
Have you seen that photograph he talked about of the march of the Black military? Can you Google real quickly Harlem Hellcats Maybe we can share that on the screen or talk about it if it comes up here. But, you know, and I just remember seeing that either in video or photographs of it as a kid. But the other thing that was like that was the parades put on by Marcus Garvey, right? And the movement that he created centered, I think, in New York as well. That was the center of our world. But you know, this whole thing of order and orderliness that military systems and processes represent and reflect, right, and that we, you know, we do, and we own it in a way that's beautiful as well, that is special. It's like, yeah, put the photograph up. There's a photograph, I'll describe it to the listeners on KFAI, and this is off of a web page by American Battle Monuments Commission, and it says the Harlem Hellfighters, the most storied Black combat unit of World War I, you know, and let me just share some of that with you now. It says that on the Western Front, let me bring my notes down here, you know, death did not, this is a story written probably in February of 2021. On the Western Front of World War I, death did not discriminate. Artillery screaming towards the trenches treated men of all color the same. The soldiers of the 92nd and 93rd Divisions lived segregated lives both in and out of war. These all-Black units, which served mostly under white officers, readily took up arms with their fellow Americans, hopeful that their patriotism and service would lead to better treatment at home. In the end, the Harlem Hellfighters, as they were likely first dubbed by their German adversaries, spent more time in continuous combat than any other American unit of its size, with 191 days in the front line trenches, according to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. The unit also suffered 1,400 total casualties, was more than any other American regiment, and many of those soldiers are now buried or memorialized at American military cemeteries overseas that are managed by the American Battle Monuments Commission. But more than 350,000 African Americans served in World War I. And the majority of them were assigned to labor and stevedore battalions. Stevedore meant they dug the ditches and they built the roads, they supplied the front lines. And throughout the course of World War I, only 1 in 10 of the African Americans in the US military served in a combat role. And that was based on the leadership decisions at the time. Our guests talked about, at the one hand, there was a fear of placing arms, weapons, in the hands of Black men and women in the military. But they said the 369th Infantry Regiment of the 93rd Division, which is formerly the 15th New York National Guard Regiment, was unique. The 369th landed at Brest, France, on December of 1917. In March of 1918, this regiment began training under French command due to the French need for replacements. And despite the expectation that this arrangement will be temporary, the members of the 369th never served under American command during the war. So by summer, they were fighting in the Champagne-Marne defense and the, I can't read French well, Aisne-Marne offensive, I think that's correct. And it would be then that the Harlem Hellfighters would see grisly combat during the Muzagon offensive, which began in September of 1918. As the 369th advanced, I'll close out there, I guess. Okay, go on. It's a good story. I mean, yeah, I'm reading it.
Yeah, it is a very good story. And I've heard about the Harlem Hellfighters. I live in Harlem. There's so much more to learn. I want to actually kind of interrupt this part of the segment because we actually have Anika Robbins, who has this exciting announcement in celebration of Black African American Music Month and Juneteenth. And I invited her on to kind of hop on and really talk to us about what's going on. And she's going to come back next week. So Anika, we'll be right here. Give me 1 second. Let me bring you in.
Hey, Anika.
You mute it.
Unmute.
I am. Hey, brother. How you doing?
I'm great. Good to see you. Thank you for jumping on. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm in a coffee shop, so let me know if I'm too, if the background is loud.
No, it's just fine. And thank you for calling. What's going on?
Man, everything and everything. But
we got about 5 minutes, so
we'll. All right, let me give my quick elevator speech. So the Anika Foundation is producing Juneteenth, Minnesota 2023, a family celebration. We are going to be at the Allianz Field on 400 Snelling Street Avenue in St. Paul. We're excited. This is our second annual, and I'm elated to have, so it's a lot happening, right? It's a hot Black June in summer 2023, and we're here for it. So in addition to our regular offerings of, you know, a wellness way featuring several wellness vendors, our legacy pavilion featuring business, home ownership, and other resources. We're doing food distribution with Second Heartland Harvest and Mount Olivet Lab School. But listen, let me tell you about this ode to hip hop, this ode to Black music. Mm-hmm. And I'm sad, you know, Gary Hines and I, with the Sounds of Blackness, we were talking about how no one's really talking about the fact that June is Black Music Month.
Right.
Oh, like we're losing grip on our history and our culture and our soul. With that said, the Sounds of Blackness will be joining us, headlining our event on Saturday, June 17th. But we also have some St. Paul legends. We have legendary Dan Speak on the ones and twos. We have DJ who will be our signature DJ all day. And then we have Truth Mays, Muja Messiah, and several other artists that we are in the process of confirming. And I'm just really excited about it. But Mr. Al, listen, we're also giving away $5,000 in 2023 Minnesota high school graduates. So really excited to be doing that. We're having them complete an essay about what their vision is for the community and what they're going to do to create it. And these stories are just so compelling. And then we created an award called the Community Griot Awards. Mm-hmm. And there's so many folks, you know, not only are more veteran elders, but there are several emerging mm-hmm. griots, you know, folks who may be 30, 40 years old, but they are making their mark. So we're going to be honoring them as well. And last but not least, we're giving away small business awards to emerging businesses. So this is the year of, this is the time of reclamation, you know, building and solidifying our legacy. Again, that date is Saturday, June 17th at Allianz Field. Thankful for support from Ignite Foundation, Ramsey County Health, Housing, and Minnesota United Football Club, who they wanted us back. So I thought that was awesome. So awesome. Thank you for letting me come on.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you called up. And obviously, our door and our microphones are always open for you. You'll be on again next week, right? Between now and then to promote it.
If you have me, I will be here.
We'll make it happen. Make it
happen. All right. Thank you so much. Thanks to Yasmin.
Which coffee shop are you in?
So I'm in Chicago. I just got back.
Oh, you're in Chicago.
I'm in Chicago.
Okay.
About to head back to Minnesota, but I came to see Loose Ends and Incognito. They gave a great, legendary performance. Incognito celebrated 44 years making music. Mm-hmm. So it was great. So I'm just imbibing on all this beautiful Black music all month. Okay.
All right. Take care. Safe travel.
Thank you.
See you. Take
care. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, what a nice surprise. What a wonderful surprise to see my friend Anika Robbins, and she's doing great work. This has been a great program. Once again, we thank you, all of our friends here at KFAI, and anybody else from around the world, KFAI.org or any of the social media platforms. Support this program, support the station, Go to Insight News on YouTube, subscribe, like, and share. And we're doing this every day on our social media live stream on the radio once a week. But we appreciate you. Stay with us. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. Take care. Bye-bye.
Programming on KFAI is brought to you by Hennepin County. We all need to think about our mental well-being. We need to be checking in on each other for support.